Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening. We're brought to you, as always, through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a group of people who truly believe that each and every one of us is this nation. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is the entitlement generation. Mediocrity is the goal. First, let me explain the first half. We have currently electing congressmen and presidents and mayors and state senators and governors. The product of public education and its entitlement mentality as it has been imposed by the federal government. Everyone is entitled to an education. Well, what that means is everyone is entitled to get straight A's and be nursed through 12 years of public school and nursed through 4 additional years of college and then entitled to a beginning job in the job market making a minimum of $40,000 per year. This is what our children for the last 30 years have been told, both directly and subliminally, by the type of work they are given, the standards to which they must aspire, the work ethic that is expected of them, and the equal outcome that everybody gets a trophy and everybody is entitled to be a winner because everybody is a winner simply because they happen to be alive. Mediocrity is the goal. The second part of tonight's topic. In the ideal progressive universe, as an interesting post on Facebook said today, the liberal paradise is actually a federal prison where everyone is treated equally, everybody gets the same food, everybody has the same accommodations, both given to them to help them and accommodation in the sense of a place to live. Everyone is equal. Everyone is alike. And no one has the freedom to leave. That is mediocrity, ladies and gentlemen, and that is the goal of progressive theorists in education. That somehow or other, by entering your child into kindergarten at age 5 and continually making sure that he or she attends public school for the next 13 years will guarantee, simply because your child is there, that he or she will be eligible for and capable of learning from a college or university, simply because they exist. And if they are not eligible for or capable of learning in a college or university, it is the fault of their teachers through the 13 years they attended public schools. Because teachers are, in progressive theory, godlike beings who can create learning simply by being in a classroom and accommodating each and every child, teaching to each individual child strengths and or weaknesses, and making sure that no child is left behind, meaning that no one will be allowed to fail, and no one will be allowed to excel, because failure is not an option, it damages self-esteem, and to excel is an evil, greedy, capitalist notion that makes people who aren't as smart as you feel bad. Our public education system was initially envisioned by our founding fathers as an opportunity for the poorest of our citizens to have access to knowledge and learning, which would give them skills and mental exercise so that they could rise above poverty and become successful citizens in all ways, not just materially, and that their children would come from a better state and have more than they did. Our founding fathers' views on education were not about equal outcomes, because they were smart enough to understand that with human beings, you're not going to get those, no matter how many regulations or theories you put in place in any institution, let alone public schools. There is no way, ladies and gentlemen, that all the kindness and self-esteem building in the world would have gotten me to be any good at auto mechanics. I have no aptitude. I have no interest. I dislike mechanical contrivances intensely. I name my appliances because it makes me nervous not to. I relate to living things, not machines. That does not mean that I am stupid, useless, incapable of being a functioning citizen, and a reasonably intelligent adult. It merely means that my tastes, talents, and skills are not the same as the guy in the seat next to me who loves taking apart Dad's lawnmower and putting it back together again so it runs even better than before. We have spent 30 years telling our children that the only pathway to success is to be nursed through public education, both at the elementary and secondary level, and then catapulted into a college or university, and nursed through that so that you can become anything from a professional football player to CEO of the largest brokerage firm on Wall Street, simply by attending public schools in the care of these godlike teachers who, by magic, can put brains in the heads of people who don't have them, get brains in the heads of people who do have them to be actually used in the process of learning, and while they do both those things, make sure that every child is happy, content, and never, ever makes a mistake. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the fundamental reason why so many talented, dedicated, passionate teachers don't last longer than 5 years in the current public school system. I'd like you to imagine that you apply for a job in a business and you are hired. And then the business owner, your employer, tells you that you are to take buckets of mud from the back premises of the property of the business and through sheer will and effort, turn those buckets of mud into gold. You may not add anything or take anything away. You may not stir up the bucket. You may not empty it or fill it with something else. You may not do anything except talk to the bucket and tell it and its contents how wonderful it is, and that if it just sits still and listens, soon it will turn to gold. Would you be willing to stay on a job like that? I wouldn't. Even though I do stay on a job like that, I am very, very, very lucky because I am not a classroom teacher in the traditional sense. My job is to deal with the students who have pushed the limits of the rules to the point where consequences must be delivered to indicate to them that their behaviors are inappropriate. And to do that job, I have to create a classroom environment that is considered to be punitive. The fact that my classroom environment is basically the same kind of classroom environment that I had when I was in regular classes going all the way through 12 grades. You raised your hand and waited to be called upon before you spoke. You sat still and did your work. You politely asked a question if you didn't understand. You listened to the teacher. You completed your assignments to the best of your ability. You did your homework at home and brought it in the next day, and it was checked and gone over. You read material that was assigned to you, and if you didn't know a word, you asked for help or got a dictionary. You expected to be given a grade that you had earned. If there were 20 questions on the test and you missed 15 of them, you got an F. No one read the test to you. No one wrote the answers down for you. No one gave you the test ahead of time to study, so all you had to do was memorize the letter of a multiple choice answer. You had to ask permission to use the restroom. You had to remain in your seat unless you were given permission to get up. You were expected to have the materials to work with, but if you forgot your pencil, the teacher would lend you one, and you would return it to him or her at the end of the day and remember to bring one of your own tomorrow. This pretty well describes the atmosphere in my in-school suspension room. Unfortunately, this is considered a punitive environment. The fact that my students quite often tell me, you know, Mrs. Rowland, I really don't like ISS, but boy, I sure did get a lot of work done and I learned something today, ought to wake people up. But because teachers have no control over how their classroom should be run or the rules in that classroom, if they set rules like the ones I maintain, there will be hordes of parents beating down the doors of the principal's office complaining about how cruelly their poor, delicate child with a learning disability or a behavioral problem is being treated. The teacher doesn't like him and she's being mean to him, and he can't learn if he doesn't like the teacher. This system, ladies and gentlemen, is irretrievably broken. It cannot continue the way it is constituted now. There are ways to change things, but they are not ways that drive good teachers out of the profession. My friend Linda gave me a heads up to check out a letter on the Blaze website. The letter is from a veteran teacher who teaches in Syracuse, New York, at a secondary school, a high school. And he is a history teacher, and he has taught for 27 years. And he is resigning. He is resigning because he no longer has control over his classroom. He cannot take the time to go over material that the students are having difficulty with because it departs from the data-driven testing schedule imposed upon all high schools in the state of New York to meet the standards of learning, Common Core, statewide curricular expectations, whatever it's called there. This teacher cannot take the time to meet with his colleagues to discuss different ways to present material. He cannot manage to try to introduce new or more interesting ways because all of his planning time is taken up with meetings or submitting data or going over the standards so that his test matches every other test in every other high school or every other history teacher in his high school. And he can no longer do the job for which he was trained and for which he has had a lifelong passion. Because his value as an individual is infinitely less than a piece of paper with test scores on it indicating that everybody in his class has met the expectations of the bell curve. There was another interesting little article on the Blaze that I saw today. I didn't get a chance to read all of it. Apparently, a crossword given as an assignment to an eighth grade class somewhere in the country had two definitions to go into the crossword. One was a definition of conservatism, and one was a definition of liberalism. And the correct answer for conservatism was restricting individual freedom. And the correct answer for liberalism was individual freedom for all. In other words, anyone who is a political conservative is by nature and by training and by mindset, only interested in restricting the freedom of others. Whereas everyone who is a liberal is interested in making sure that everyone has ultimate freedom. No exceptions. Everybody is perfectly free to do everything they want. Now, that ought to give you an indication that we are no longer educating children, we are indoctrinating them to be, as my friend Linda said, clones. We are creating in our public schools, ladies and gentlemen, the Borg Collective. If any of you out there are not Star Trek Next Generation fans, I'm sorry to use a reference that may not be familiar to you. Those of you who are viewers or fans of Next Gen will know exactly what I mean by the Borg Collective. For those of you who do not, the Borg Collective was a villainous society of space-faring people who were half machine and half organic. They had a hive mind. They adapted quickly because all of them were hooked together and none of them was an individual. Every one of them reacted just as your finger reacts when you twitch it, to the directives of a central brain, if you will, that used these non-individuals as multiple tools to achieve the domination of all other beings which they encountered. And their domination was called assimilation. Once they had conquered or assimilated a group of beings, those beings were incorporated into the Borg collective, so that they no longer had any individuality, any memory of individuality, or any concept of individuality. They were safe. They never had to make a decision. They could never make an error. They were merely extensions of the collective consciousness, happy and safe. This is what our public schools, in spite of liberal rhetoric, which states, we want every child to have an equal chance at life. We want everyone to be free. No, they don't. Freedom to the Borg collective is the freedom to follow orders. That is the only freedom the Borg collective knows. And that is the only freedom that progressives want you and your children to know. The illusion of perfect safety and a risk-free life. You will never fail because we won't permit you to. You will never make a bad choice because there will always only be one thing that you can do in any given situation. On Tuesdays, you will have vanilla ice cream, so you won't have the choice of possibly wanting peach, which might upset your stomach. Every morning, you will rise at the specific time that everyone else rises, and you will get into your vehicle, which will be propelled along with every other vehicle to the appropriate stop in the collective mind, which is otherwise known as the city, and you will be unloaded to go to your cubicle and perform the duties that the collective requires of you. And you will be told that you are an essential part of the great machine, and that you cannot possibly do anything wrong because every moment of your day will be watched and monitored, and you will be nudged into making the correct choice because it will be the only choice you have. This is what our children are being groomed for, ladies and gentlemen. And I know there are those of you out there who are going to say, oh my God, she's a crazy old lady with a conspiracy theory. Well, that might be quite true. Maybe I am crazy in the liberal universe. Maybe I do have a conspiracy theory because there really is a conspiracy. To conspire means to get together with others in order to commit an act that is either immoral, unethical, or illegal. And what the progressives in the educational field are doing is getting together to commit an act that is all three of those things. To basically tell our children that no one can excel, no one can fail, no one can make a good choice, so no one will have to go through the horrible dilemma of having to make any choice at all. Everyone will learn exactly the same things. Everyone will have exactly the same opinions. Nobody will argue because there won't be any reason to. There will be only one opinion, the opinion the progressives wish you to hold. You will have freedom of speech because the only possible speech will be to agree with the progressive hive mind. You will be perfectly safe because no one will ever have an individual choice to do anything that the collective disapproves of. You will not be permitted to eat too much, drink too much, walk too much, sleep too much, think too much, read too much, play too much, or do anything too much, because you will only be permitted to do any of those things if the collective deems that everybody should do those things, and only for a certain period of time, or at a certain time of day, or in a certain season, and only with other members of the collective, so that you can share equally in the delight of whatever it is the hive mind says you ought to do. You will be happy. You will be safe. You will never have to make a difficult choice, because you will never have to make a choice at all. Doesn't that sound wonderful? I'll bet you just can't wait to rush to the time machine that somebody says they invented and turn yourself back to about 8 years old and then transfer it forward so you can go through this wonderful educational system that will make you a part of the collective. How many of you out there would jump at the chance to do the regression to an 8-year-old and then come back and go into third grade and be educated to become a board? Yeah, my friend Yo says, so excited. Not. Yeah. I agree with my friend Yola. No, I don't want to do it either. I like me, crazy old lady with conspiracy theory or not. I genuinely like me. And I was married to a man for 16 years who genuinely liked me too. And he liked himself, and I liked him. Because we were not alike. We had different views about a lot of different things. But we loved one another truly and deeply. And our discussions and arguments were always based on opinions or ideas, and never personal attacks on either one of us. Because we were taught throughout our lives that freedom, the freedom of speech, the freedom of worship, the freedom to do what you find pleasurable, came with responsibility and came with a chance of failing to achieve the goal you set yourself. And nobody told either one of us that we shouldn't have to make choices. On the contrary, both of us were told from the time we were old enough to understand language that every day we would make choices, and we were guided by our parents, our teachers, our spiritual leaders, even our political leaders, to examine our choice before we irrevocably made it and understand the consequences, and then deal with those consequences depending upon what decision we made. We were not told that we would get do-overs. We were not told that someone else would fix it if we screwed it up because we weren't paying attention or didn't know what we were doing. And believe me, we were very different in our approaches to things. My husband would open a box of something that was supposed to be put together, take all the pieces out, and then try to figure out how they went together. And then when he couldn't get it to fit, then he'd look at the instructions. I'm the opposite. I leave everything in the box so I can find it. I read the directions and then place the materials in order of how they go together. But I do not have, to this day, his ability to imagine something and build it straight out of his brain. And there was no way that I would have let him handle the checkbook in a million years. Because that skill he did not have, and I did. I could no more build a greenhouse in the backyard than I can fly to the moon unassisted without a spacesuit. But my husband could, and he did. From his head. Not from a plan, not from a set of directions, but from his ability to visualize in three dimensions. And neither of us resented or disliked the other for our different styles and our different skills and our different talents. We blended them together, and together we had a happy, successful, joyous marriage. Because we were never taught that the key to having a good relationship was to finding someone who is exactly like oneself in every way. Because, ladies and gentlemen, our parents were smart, and they knew there was never going to be anybody who was like either one of us in every way, any more than there are two snowflakes that are identical, although science may have disproven that in the last week and a half, I don't know. Progressives and liberals are very fond of the word diversity, but they have no real understanding of, or don't wish to admit that they understand, the true meaning of diversity. Diversity is not paying lip service to any and all belief system, political systems, historical societies, saying they were all wonderful and none was better than the other. That is not diversity. That is the Borg collective again. That is assimilation. All things are good so long as the collective tells me they are. True diversity is individualism. The uniqueness of each and every one of us human children of God. Every single one of us has something to offer. And all we need to be able to do that is opportunity. Not entitlement to success or outcome of that opportunity, but just the shot at it. The chance to try. And the chance to try different things. To try to discover what we're good at. What gives us joy. What we're passionate about. What we believe in. It's necessary when raising children to give them a framework within which they can feel safe so that when they take those first hesitant steps outside the family framework, they have something to come back to give them a safe spot to think about and try to understand and put in some sort of rational view the things that they discover outside of their family framework. Without a framework, without a structure of behavioral norms, of expected parameters for interacting with others, without an understanding of what one can do and what one should do, and what one cannot do, and what one should not do, we will have either feral animals who look like humans, or sheep who will follow whatever bellwether has the biggest bundle of hay under her tail, and will let them eat it unrestrainedly. Mediocrity, ladies and gentlemen, is elevating the average to become a symbol for excellence. To strive to be average, to strive to fit in, to strive to be part of the group, is underlying 99% of the way our children are taught. Children who are bright are slowed down and often told that they shouldn't demonstrate it because it will make other children feel bad. Children who are stupid are told that they are wonderful and that everybody loves them, and that the world always will love them, and they really don't have to try harder because somebody will always take care of them and everybody will love them because they at least were there and they tried something. The incredible dichotomy, the split, the Janus-like two-faced nature of progressive liberalism that wants everyone to have equal stuff in everybody's house sits in awe at the feet of entertainers who have a talent or a skill not possessed by others and who become incredibly wealthy by exercising it and sees them as role models, or at least says they do. Progressive liberalism isn't interested in those people for their skill or their talent. They are interested in those people because most of them are so busy exercising that talent or skill to the exclusion of anything else that they're very easy to manipulate. Because they live in a world of make-believe. They live fully only when they are on stage. Whether that stage is a football stadium, a Broadway stage, a sound stage in the Hollywood Movie Factory, a Vegas nightclub stage, or a political stage where they are endorsing a candidate and hoping and assuming that their adoring fans will immediately vote for that person because a talented actor told them to. They're also very pretty to look at in some way. And most people prefer to look at pretty things rather than not so pretty things. So pretty faces and handsome faces and beautiful bodies and talent or skill at make-believe, at entertaining people, to the progressive liberals, are the ideal recruiters for more voters to their cause. Because everything with progressive liberals is on the surface. None of all the nice things that they say they want to have happen to you are actually what they want. They want you to believe that you will be as happy and successful and wealthy and beautiful as their happy, little, successful, wealthy, beautiful, entertaining spokesperson or campaign adjuncts. Because, subliminally, people will look at the actor or actress or football player or whatever and say, well, gee whiz, look how great they are. Maybe if I vote for this guy, some of that greatness that they have is going to rub off on me. And it isn't a conscious thought, ladies and gentlemen. It is quite literally subliminal. People often choose behaviors or choose to purchase something or live in a place or go somewhere because someone famous tells them, I go here and I like it. And subconsciously, they're thinking, well, gee, if Beyonce goes there, obviously, if I go there, I'm going to be as talented and famous, or I'm going to feel like Beyonce. That's been used in advertising ever since the caveman wrote up an advertisement in Rocks with his good-looking wife to have you come share his fire if you brought dinner. It's window dressing, as my friend Linda says. Progressives understand how to manipulate people by using emotion and skewed perception. And this is what they are doing in our schools. They are basing success for school children on how the child feels and not what the child knows. Education is not about training your feelings, ladies and gentlemen. Education is about training your mind. It is about reason and fact and understanding how historical events produce consequences and seeing the relationship in the physical universe among atoms and molecules and compounds and mixtures and understanding how numbers work so that you can understand quantity and compare size and shape so that your physical world will be understandable and you can work within it and accomplish what you need to. Education is not about making you feel good about yourself. Feeling good about yourself is something that develops when you achieve a goal you have set for yourself. Not when somebody gives you a prize simply because you happen to show up at a football game, wear a uniform, and sit on the bench all day. But progressives use emotion, ladies and gentlemen. That's one of the reasons that so many people become mesmerized and spellbound with all of the lovely sounding promises. Because when you look at what they promise you, who would not want to feel safe? Who would not want to feel that everybody cared about them and wanted to help them if they were in trouble? Who would not want to feel that they were important simply because they were themselves? We all want to feel those things. It's built in. Every single living human being wishes to be successful mentally, emotionally, and physically and materially. Nobody grows up saying, gee, I can't wait to be a failure, or boy, I can't wait to be homeless, or boy, I wish I could be a bum on the street corner, and boy, I think being an alcoholic would be the best thing in the whole world, and I'm going to study that when I go to college. But unfortunately, because we are educating our children out of their mind and into what they feel, more and more and more of them are going to buy into the "we'll make sure that you're perfectly comfortable, perfectly content, never make a mistake, and have everything you want. All you have to do is give up your freedom of choice." And you really don't want to choose anyway, because you might make a bad one. And then life wouldn't be safe and comfortable and happy. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure that you have exactly the same kind of stuff in your house as that guy down the street does. I hope you notice that Reverend Sharpton's "equal stuff in everybody's house" didn't define exactly what that stuff was going to be. Every cell in a federal prison has equal stuff in it, ladies and gentlemen. It also has bars on the door and you don't have a key. But our children are being educated to believe that that sort of prison society is the ultimate good. That happy little crossword that conservatism is wishing to restrict the rights of others and the freedom of others, and liberalism is freedom for everybody. Classic liberalism is freedom for everybody. But that's not what we have now, ladies and gentlemen. We have progressive liberalism, otherwise known as Fabian socialism. To be a liberal, okay, used to mean that you were for less individual restrictions on behaviors and more options available for everyone. Doesn't mean that now. Now it means you'll have the same options as everybody else because everybody else will only have one option. Conservatism used to mean preserving the status quo, and usually meant that the people who were conservative generally were successful with society at its current level of regulation and interaction. They were successful and comfortable with the way society worked, so therefore they were not interested in changing it in any way, and especially not in a radical or unusual way. Whereas liberalism, or liberals, were interested in tinkering with it and seeing if they couldn't make it more free when it came to choice. Well, again, progressive educational theorists and their happy little indoctrination have redefined the words. Because words only mean what you want them to mean at any given moment in a political speech. And it's true that language does change. Just look at the evolution of the word racist. It used to mean making the assumption that one race is better than another. That's what being racist meant. Now, if you look in a dictionary, being racist means that you dislike, distrust, and wish to restrict the activities of people who are not white. And that's pretty much the definition now. Which is why only white people can be racist, in today's meaning of the word. In the old meaning, the actual dictionary definition, meant that you believed that one race was superior to another. Not necessarily the Caucasian race, the Negroid race, the Oriental race, the Amerindian race, the Basque race, just anyone. You could be a racist no matter what race you belong to, if you believed that your particular race was superior to all the others. But that's not what it means now. Now, it's an epithet, a term that describes anyone who is not a member of a quote-unquote minority in American society or in Western European society. Our happy little public schools, as Doc so aptly put it, are operating on the Hillary Clinton, it takes a village theory. In other words, like the commentator on, I believe it was MSNBC, who said your children belong to the state, in effect, that no, they don't really belong to you. They belong to all of us. So all of us should have a say in what you teach them and how you raise them because they're not really yours. I wonder if she would actually do, if she were asked, what we do when we raise children. If they're hers, I think she should go to every household in the country and change every baby's diapers at least once over the entire country. I mean, they're hers, aren't they? They belong to her as much as they do to anybody else. That's the first time I've ever heard anybody say that what you have is mine. And actually believe it. Now, I've heard many communists and socialists and Fabian socialists and liberal progressives and all the rest of them say that basically the same thing, only they weren't quite as straightforward or as blunt about it. They were a little more devious and subtle. They believe that what I have belongs to them or anybody they say should have it. They just don't walk in and physically take away what I have. They just tax everything I do so that I can't have it anymore and use that tax money to buy it for the people who don't pay taxes because they've been deprived. And Doc quoted Hitler saying the children were the property of the Reich, and that's quite true. That was the way Nazi Germany worked. Children in school were taught to view the Reich as their parents, not their biological parents. They were told that their parents were not to be trusted, that the only thing that they should trust was the state, the Reich, the government, because the government had their best interests at heart and would make sure that they never wanted. In Soviet schools, quite often first graders, back in the 1950s, would be told in their classrooms, "Everybody close your eyes and pray for candy." So the children obediently closed their eyes and prayed for candy for 5 minutes or so. And then the teacher would say, "Open your eyes. Now look at your desk. Is there any candy there?" And they went, "No, no candy." Then the teacher would say, "All right, close your eyes and ask the state for candy." And so the children obediently closed their eyes. And while their eyes were closed, someone crept quietly around and placed a piece of candy on every desk. And then the teacher said, "Now, open your eyes." And, "Wow, candy!" And the teacher would say, "You see, this is what you are here to learn." And it worked. Many people disliked Catholic education because they saw that as indoctrination. Well, the church is pretty doggone smart and has been for a couple thousand years. The church has always said, "Give a child to me until he or she is seven, and they are mine for life." Because they understand that the quickest and surest way to mold a population into what you want them to be is to start when they are young. And that is what our public schools have become, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks to people like Thomas Dewey and people like Hillary Clinton and people like Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Arnie Duncan and 90% of the appointed czars and cabinet members in the current administration, not just in the Department of Education, and the liberal professors on college campuses. There are way more conservative teachers out there, ladies and gentlemen, than most of you know. I would make a guess that conservatives among teachers probably outnumber liberals. It's probably 60 to 65% conservative and 35 to 40% liberal. And the ones who are liberal are the ones who are in supervisory positions. Because the money comes from liberals right now. Federal funds, ladies and gentlemen, that are tied to specific programs, like No Child Left Behind. The history teacher who wrote whose resignation letter was posted on the Blaze, Gerald J. Conte, knew that that was the case. Our kids have been sold out to testing manufacturers. But he's only half right. It isn't only the test manufacturers who are making money off of our children's lack of education. It is every member of the federal government, elected or appointed or hired. And don't get me wrong, everybody has to make a living. My friend Doc is talking about the behaviors of children who are indoctrinated from Orwell's 1984, which is a pattern based on exactly what happened in the Third Reich under Hitler. And that's exactly what is happening again. Granted, we don't have brown shirts standing in front of the schools. We don't have our children drilling with weapons to become the new Hitler youth. But we do have the Obama Youth Corps, don't we? And if you've ever seen pictures of the Obama Youth Corps, they're not unarmed, ladies and gentlemen. Their community service apparently includes lots more than washing windows and cleaning up parks. But just because we don't have it yet doesn't mean that it's impossible for it to happen here. It is not impossible, because the seeds have already been sown. The seeds are growing while parents turn their backs and sue the school system because their child has not been treated properly when he or she disrupts the class, but he can't help it because he has a behavioral disability. I had a chat with a special education teacher today. Yesterday, I had to substitute in a collaborative classroom, and one of the paraprofessional aides was not there, so I filled in for them. Actually, I filled in for the special ed teacher who was not there. And a student had to be redirected constantly to complete his work, because every time he was redirected, he immediately started talking and arguing about how he didn't do that, or somebody else did this, or he started a conversation with his seatmate, or he was playing with something, or getting up and wanting to go to the bathroom. And the constant redirection was disturbing every other child in his vicinity. So he was finally told to leave the classroom. And the teacher asked me to go out and talk with him, and I did. And the first thing he did was tell me, oh, well, the special education teacher who normally was there, they can tell you that the teacher picks on me. She hates me, and she's always blaming me for stuff that I don't do. And it's not my fault. You know, somebody talks to me, and she just doesn't like me, and she's mean to me. And I said, okay, now wait a minute. Have you ever heard of the golden rule? He said, yeah, treat other people the way you want to be treated. I said, okay, let's go from there. If you're trying to do your work and somebody's talking and laughing and playing and disturbing you, doesn't that bother you? Oh, no, because I don't notice it. I said, wait a minute. I've been in the same classroom with you, and yes, you do. And you get very annoyed when people disrupt you when you're trying to work. Yeah, well, that doesn't mean it. I said, okay. What do you think happens to the students around you when you're talking and laughing and not working? Well, she doesn't like me. She just treats me that way because she doesn't like me. I said, I have not seen her treat you in any way other than the way she should, to get you to do the work you're supposed to do. Well, you can ask the special education teacher. She said so. She said that she knows. She told me. I said, that special education teacher is not here, so I can't ask her. I can only base this on what I saw. Well, I said, all right, class is almost over. You go back in and collect your things. And you think about that golden rule for a while. Well, apparently the student got home and ranted and raved to Mama, and Mama called the school immediately, demanding that the special education teacher do something about how badly her child had been treated. So the special education teacher asked me to tell her what happened. And I did, exactly as I told it to you. And, of course, she had never told the child that the teacher didn't like him or the teacher was picking on him. She had never implied it. This was the child's take, because this particular child will use any tactic, including flat-out lies, to shift the blame for his inability to do what he is told onto everyone but himself. And Mama has done this to her child. Now, if that child belongs to the state can have him and put him in a nice state institution, because he's likely to wind up in one. That liberal paradise with everybody has the same stuff in everybody's cell and locks on the doors. Because as far as he's concerned, nothing is ever his fault. He is never wrong. He has never made the mistake. Someone else is responsible for his behavior. And Mama encourages it. And because the school is terrified of being sued, because this particular child has an IEP, an individualized education plan, which means that his education is overseen by the Federal Department of Education and its interpretation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, if the school does anything that the mother construes as violating his accommodations, the school will not only potentially be sued by the mother, they may potentially lose their funds and their accreditation. Because the threat of Mama not being happy with her dear little boy's accommodations can cost the school more than it's willing to pay. So the progressive, liberal, educational machine wins again. I was talking to another teacher yesterday, day before yesterday. Yesterday it was, yeah. Our eighth graders were doing the Virginia Standards of Learning writing test on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. And on Wednesday, one of the teachers that was proctoring and monitoring was absent. So I was asked to substitute. And after the testing was over with, and the eighth graders came back to the middle school, the group that I was with did their testing at the high school because our middle school didn't have enough computers for everybody to in the eighth grade to have one. So three or four classes were sent over to the high school to use the computer labs there. And it's, you know, basically right behind us. It's a five-minute walk. And when we got back to the middle school, when they were done with testing, they had their lunch, and then because there were still students testing, the schedule that they had mapped out wasn't going to work because, of course, you cannot tell a student that they have to complete it within a given period of time because that's not fair. They're allowed to take as long as they need. The students were allowed to, the eighth graders were allowed to go outside and relax and walk around the track and get fresh air after the incredible agony of 2.5 hours of writing a short paper based on a prompt. And while they were outside, I was sitting underneath the bleachers in the shade, mainly because there's no shade on the track and I get sun poisoning. And a couple of other teachers joined me. And one of them was talking about the fact that one of her students is failing everything. And she was trying to talk to him about, you know, putting forth some effort. And granted, he has learning difficulties, but he's accommodated by lots of things. He has his own laptop because you can't read his handwriting. But he refuses to use it because it's a lot easier just not to do the work. But anyway, she was trying to get through to him that if he goes on the way he's going, that he's not going to get out of eighth grade. And he said, oh, yes, I am. The guidance counselor went over my ninth grade schedule with me, so I'll pass. And he's probably right. He will. Because when the teacher went to the administration and said that his overall grades were abysmal, and that she advised retention, the only question they asked was, how old is he? And that tells you right there that he'll be passed. Because it would damage his self-esteem to be held back and be older than everybody else in the class. So he'll be passed on to the high school. And there he will either all of a sudden have an incredible St. Paul on the road to Damascus awakening and discover that knowledge has value, or he will continue to do absolutely nothing and blithely assume that somebody's going to graduate him with a diploma, and then he can go do whatever he wants to do in some way without any skills that will allow him to earn a living. Mediocrity, ladies and gentlemen. The goal. Well, you can't hold me back. It'll make me feel bad. Yeah, it probably will. But what will make you feel bad isn't based on the fact that you didn't pass. It's based on the fact that you assumed you didn't have to put forth any effort to pass. Because that's been his experience. Granted, this is not the average. This is about 10 to 20% of the crop of students today. But this 10 to 20% is in classes with people who actually could be successful. But because the classes have to be manipulated so that these children who can't or won't learn actually pass something, the 80% of the 80% who are not like this, about 60% of them are in collaborative classes with people who are like this. And from them, they learn that, well, gee, why should I put forth any effort? All I have to do is say I can't do it, and they'll pass me anyway. Because they see it happening. They see indolence, bad behavior, refusal to abide by rules, preferential treatment, as what always happens. Is it any surprise that when they finish school, they expect those things too? I, as I said earlier, ladies and gentlemen, am extraordinarily lucky because in my classroom, it is understood that if a student cannot abide by the rules, they cannot remain in the classroom. They are removed and they are sent home for out-of-school suspension, and they don't stay to disrupt everybody who is obeying the rules. That happened today with two students. I had to remove them from the classroom. And they both have been suspended. Their behavior was abominable. It was inappropriate in all ways. They were given every chance to amend their behavior. Nothing worked. And it culminated in my marching both of them to the office. And subsequently, they're being sent home with hopefully at least one day, possibly more, of out-of-school suspension. And if they are sent back to me and their behavior is the same thing will happen. And if it doesn't, if it gets to the point where my classroom has to accommodate behavior like that, then I too will write a letter of resignation with great sadness and great reluctance, and not just for the income I'm losing, but for not being able to do the job and be the professional that I am. Not being able to exercise my passion for learning, my desire to open the doors of opportunity for children, my wish to give them something that no one can ever take from them, knowledge. It will break my heart to lose that. But should it come to pass that my classroom becomes like that, I will no longer be in charge of it. Because I refuse, ladies and gentlemen, to sacrifice my integrity to the whims of progressive liberalism and its deliberate attempt to sabotage our future by sabotaging our children. I continue to do what I do because I believe that something I may say or teach might spark a mind. I have no guarantees that that will happen. I believe it will. I have to believe it will. Otherwise, I would be crazy old lady with conspiracy theory and certifiable. But I'm lucky in other ways, too, because I know for a fact that it does happen. I've been in the business of educating people for a very long time, and I have had former students come back to me 20 years later and tell me that they remembered something I taught them, and it was of value to them. Knowing that it can happen is what keeps me doing it. And there are many, many teachers like me, even though I don't have the professional tag of teacher. I do teach. And I love it. But if I cannot do it with integrity and honesty and stand up for what I believe, then I won't do it at all. And if it means that I lose the ability to afford internet and I can't give my opinion to all of you out there because I don't make enough money to do so, then so be it. Because I don't do this show, ladies and gentlemen, because I think it's going to make me famous or wealthy. God knows it's not going to do either one. I do it because I believe in what I say. And I do it because I believe in your children and your grandchildren. And I believe in the resilience and strength of the human spirit and the human mind and the human heart. And I believe sincerely and honestly that the most valuable commodity you can ever own is knowledge. And that once you are able to know where to look for it, no one can stop you from acquiring it. And once you have it, no one can stop you from implementing it. And if I can give that to some children, or even one child that I teach, then I'll be quite happy to stand and be judged when I leave this life. Because I think that will count in the scales a lot more than many of the mistakes I've made and many of the petty angers and so on and so forth that I've committed in my life. I won't say that it will be make me a saint, because I'm not in the business of being a saint. But I think that when it comes to having my life weighed, that desire to tell the truth and teach will count for something in the final analysis. And if I did not do that, tell the truth and teach what I believe, and stand up for what I believe, then I would be found wanting at the end. And I really don't want that to happen. Not because of fear of damnation or hell or fiery furnaces or the Norse, frozen hell or Dante's crazy places or anybody else's version of the afterlife of eternal punishment. That's not what motivates me. What motivates me is basically to do something that is worthwhile. And that something for me is to teach. If I can't do it, As I said, it will be heartbreaking. But I can't do half a job, ladies and gentlemen. I can't pretend to be something other than what I am. Because in general, I like me. Not because people told me all my life that I was wonderful, but because I've learned about myself through making mistakes, making bad choices, and doing what I can to deal with the consequences as positively as I can, and as beneficially to those around me as I possibly can. And if, along with how to do fractions and the dates of the Battle of Hastings, I can maybe convey some of that to the kids I teach, then I figure I've had a pretty good life. So it's about time for us to close for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I've got a caller coming in. Let's see who's on the line. Hello.
Oh, hi, it's me. I wanted to congratulate you on an incredible show again. And, you know, you're the bird. I'm the bird from California, the rare one out here. But
California conservative.
You talked about mediocrity, and I had many years ago, we won't even talk about how many, but he was a dance teacher, and he was like an amazing man, and he hated mediocrity, and he talked about it. And after an hour and a half, and he made us strive. Mm-hmm. He'd say, do it again. And another 15 minutes, we were dying. We were literally hanging on the bar, wheezing. Do it again. Until he got us to the level where he would say, okay, class is dismissed. Yep. As we crawled out the door. And he says, you guys think you're good because, you know, you're pretty good in this class. He says, you go to an audition and you'll mm-hmm. see what mediocrity is all about. He says, because there's going to be 10 or 20 other dancers who are going to get that job before you because they've done their work. He says, and then you come back to me and tell me what you found. And that's why he did it. He knew.
I had the same situation today in my happy little classroom. Basically, it comes up at least once every time I have prisoners in my jail. Why do I have to know this? Or, gee, this is too hard. And I remind them that, look, you get out there in that big, cold, cruel world.
Yep.
Once you go to school, you don't get do-overs.
Exactly.
First time, you don't have a job, which means you can't pay your rent, which means they're not going to let you stay there for free. You're going to be on the street. When you don't put forth an effort to do whatever it is you're assigned correctly and well, it isn't just a bad grade on your report card and losing your Nintendo for a week.
Right.
But
another, brick wall.
Some of them get it. And I can
sure. only know
which ones are getting it from home as well. Because they nod and say, my mom says the same thing. And I always say, your mom is a wise woman.
Good for you, Terry. Oh.
But
I know you're getting ready to wrap it up, too, but I just wanted to share that story with you because that is the difference between excellence and going to the max. You know,
teachers supposed to be, Linda.
Exactly.
Set goals that are hard to reach. That's how a person builds self-esteem, not by being told that he's wonderful, but by
exactly.
proving himself that he can achieve what he thought he couldn't by sheer guts and the willingness to work. Lord knows, you knew my David. Nobody told
mm-hmm.
him he was dyslexic. Oh, poor baby, you don't have to try.
Right.
They just told him you're going to have to work your ass off. You're going to have to work twice as hard as everybody else to get the same stuff. And
exactly.
He,
and I can't even count the times that I was rejected when I went to those first auditions, believe me.
The sheer frustration and incredible humiliation of having to have somebody else check the air in my tires because I can never get the damn little thing to go in that little spigot place, which I can't. Now,
well, that's
I can
all right.
cross stitch, I can draw, I can do calligraphy, I can do all sorts of lovely things. But when it comes to lifting a very heavy sack of garbage into my big bin to take out to the street, can't do it. I had to lay it on the side and shove it in with my feet. And then try to. I just don't have physical equipment to do that. But that
right.
doesn't mean valueless. It just means I'm not going to be really good as at riding a garbage truck, which is a good thing because I don't want to anyhow.
Exactly.
It's got to do it. And it's honest
anyway,
work.
Yes, absolutely. God bless you and thanks. And I'll let you put up. It was a great show. Wonderful.
I'm so glad you were here this evening. You and Yo and Rod and Doc and Wagon came in. And so I'll be back again. I almost didn't make it because my show wasn't scheduled, so I had to go in and schedule it. But we're all scheduled and all set up through May 30th, and I've made myself a note to remember to go in and set up the new ones after that, too. So you're stuck with me for as long as I can still talk. And I thank you, folks, for joining us tonight. And I want to ask all of you, every single one of you out there listening, I know the folks in the chat room, most of them, already know what I'm going to ask, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to ask you to watch what your children are learning in school. Don't just send them off to their room with their textbooks. Sit down and read what they're doing. Study with them. This does three things that are incredibly important. Number one, it shows them that what they learn and the fact that they learn matters to you personally. Number two, it will refresh your own memory of things that you might have learned but have forgotten because you don't use it every day. And number three, it will give you a bird's eye view of exactly what the public schools are trying to teach your kids. And you too can go to school and scream if what they are teaching violates your beliefs in any way. It isn't only atheists that can stage protests, ladies and gentlemen. It isn't only progressives like Code Pink that can run around with signs. If you believe that the schools are teaching your children something that is not true, or that is half true, or that violates the morality and ethics you are attempting to give them, then you not only have the right to protest, you have the duty to do so. And it doesn't matter what your belief system is, or your ethnicity, or anything else. Because you always have the option. And let them tell you that you don't. You have the option to seek other sources of education for your child. You may not find that the other members of the class agree with the morality and ethics that you are teaching your child. Their interpretation of what is moral and what is ethical may be slightly different from yours. But, and this is the libertarian in me, so long as their morality and ethics don't break your leg or pick your pocket, let them alone. And I give the same advice to school administrators and teachers. When you teach and when you administer staff who teach, remember that these are human beings and they have personalities and belief systems and life histories and life experiences that are different from yours. It doesn't make their life experiences better or worse, it merely makes them different. And those life experiences and belief systems are going to be part of the way they think and the way they teach. And so long as the way they think and the way they teach doesn't break anybody's leg or pick anybody's pocket, let them be themselves. Children, if they are exposed to real diversity, and that means that people are different, all people, not just different because they're a different color or they go to a different church, different because they're not you. Real diversity will teach them to think, ladies and gentlemen, and not just follow the bellwether with a large bale of hay. Real diversity is what built this nation into a world power, militarily, economically, culturally, and spiritually. Not the fake diversity of voting blocks based on ethnicity. But the real diversity of human individuality and human freedom. And our children need to be exposed to real diversity. real difference, not artificially created difference that elevates one group over another or claims that one group is a lifelong victim simply because they belong to this particular ethnicity, race, or religion. That's not diversity. That is a blame game. That is manipulation to get people reelected so that they can take over your life and the lives of your children. Not everybody in this country thinks the same way about anything. There's a saying that trying to get libertarians to agree on any political philosophy or platform is a lot like herding cats, and it's quite true. Because the essence of libertarianism is Jefferson's, if it doesn't break my leg or pick my pocket, you do what you want. Tonight on Glenn Beck, Penn Jillette was his guest. And Penn said, to him, the essence of libertarianism is that libertarians understand that they don't always know what's best for somebody else. And that is the key, ladies and gentlemen. We don't need Democratic or Republican schools. We need libertarian schools, where certain standards of courteous behavior exist for the safety of all, but where each and every child is an individual. And not artificially told that, oh yeah, you can do this and you don't have to actually do it yourself. We'll do it for you so you won't feel bad about yourself. That isn't promoting individuality, ladies and gentlemen. That is creating dependency. We can change things. I know we can. If we believe enough in the values upon which this country was built. The understanding that mankind can rule itself if and only if mankind can rule itself as individuals. And mankind has to learn to do that as individuals before they can do it as a nation or a society or a world. Take care of your children. Love them, nurture them, teach them. The very best moral and ethical value you can give your kids is a standard golden rule. Do unto others as you would be done by. Treat others the way you wish to be treated. If you can get your kids to even try to live that way, you can stand before the judgment seat and have something weighing on the good side of the scales. That is another essence of what being libertarian is. I can't make decisions for you because I'm not you. I can offer you my experience of decisions that I have made, but that's no guarantee they'll be right for you. The fact that they worked for me, maybe they might work for you, but it's still your decision. And the only way you can be perfectly safe and perfectly comfortable is if you are perfectly confined. Because there is no such thing as a risk-free life, ladies and gentlemen. If it's risk-free, it's not life. Please remember that as you teach and raise your kids, as you interact with the men and women who teach and help raise them in our public schools and our private schools. Take care of one another and be blessed. I'll see you next week at 6 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio for Patriot Education. Visit our website and listen in on Blog Talk for the Patriot Families radio shows. There's one every night of the week. We have something for everyone, ladies and gentlemen. Please join us. And please think about what we say and enjoy your agreement or disagreement because you are the nation. Good night, everyone. God bless.